Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls One Planet series. Meat consumption is rising around the world. Even as climate scientists say, in rich countries, meat consumption must rapidly decline in order to meet global climate targets. More than 80 billion animals are slaughtered for human consumption every year. That number has continuously risen for the past 60 years, according to the Food and Agriculture Organization of the UN. So what explains the rise in meat consumption, given that this issue is receiving more attention than ever? What will it take to move towards a planet-friendly diet for those who have choices? How Factory Farming Ends is a 10-part series from Vox. It takes a deep dive into the past and future of the movement against factory farming, its struggle to change our culture, politics, and plates, and how it might make real progress. The pieces include, if the left is serious about saving democracy, there's one more cause to add to the list. Ditching factory farming can help prevent another pandemic, and I'm a Black vegan. Why don't you see more of us? In the intro to the series, today's guest, Marina Boletnikova, writes, "What if we told you that there is a simple way for humanity to slash climate warming emissions, help prevent the next pandemic, and simultaneously eradicate one of the most significant moral atrocities of our time, one that nearly all of us bear some responsibility for? We're talking, of course, about factory farming." Our hope is that these stories will challenge policy leaders and the broader public to imagine a kinder, saner, truly sustainable food system. Marina Boletnikova wrote the piece, "Humanity is Failing, One of Its Greatest Moral Tests." Marina is an editor for Vox's Future Perfect section, which covers the world's big moral and technological problems, from global poverty and inequality to pandemics and factory farming. Hi, Marina. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, thank you. I'm so happy to be here. And thank you for that thorough introduction.
Well, great to have you. Thank you. We're also joined by Kenny Torella. Kenny wrote two pieces, "The World's Most Powerful Environmental Groups Help Greenwash Big Meat's Climate Impact. Organizations such as the World Wildlife Fund are laundering big meat's propaganda. At what cost? And American government built the meat industry. Now, can it build a better food system? The plant-based protein movement goes to Washington." Kenny Torella is a staff writer for Vox's Future Perfect section. He's also the author of Meat Less, a Vox newsletter designed to help readers incorporate more plant-based foods into their diets. Hi, Kenny. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me and for covering this important issue.
Well, this is an amazing package that you all put together. And Marina, in the piece that you wrote, you write that your colleagues at Vox's Future Perfect had the idea of launching a project that weighs the state of the movement against factory farming for the last 50 years. You had this idea more than a year ago. So can you tell us more about how this came together and what you were all hoping to accomplish?
Yeah, of course. So this package emerged, you know, like you said, from an idea we had a long time ago, nearly 2 years ago, to create a project that tries to grapple with how massive a problem industrial animal agriculture is, and at the same time, how seemingly intractable it's been, how hard it's been to make any meaningful progress in reining it in recent decades. The factory farm system is only getting larger in the US around the world, as you alluded to. And despite what many people think, despite all the heroic advocacy of people advocating to change the system, to improve conditions and raise public consciousness around factory farming, it's still really hard to see how we're going to change course. The number of factory farmed animals rises by the billions every year in the US and globally. And to give listeners some background, the term factory farming can be kind of slippery, but to us, it refers to in the simplest terms, it's the system that's enabled the US and much of the world to farm and slaughter and eat a stupefyingly large number of animals. The world today slaughters 80 billion, that's 80 billion land animals for food every single year. So that number includes animals like chickens, pigs, cows, goats, sheep. The US alone accounts for 10 billion of those animals every year. And that system has been made possible by technological advances in the last century, including things like the advent of antibiotics, which made it possible for massive numbers of farmed animals to be crammed together in essentially warehouses and to be able to survive those conditions. It's also been made possible by the rise of intensive monocropping that has carpeted much of the US in soybeans and corn commodity crops that feed the billions of farm animals that we eat. And, you know, it's not, factory farming doesn't exist merely to be evil, right? It exists because it's the cheapest and most efficient by a certain measure way to produce lots of cheap meat for a world of 8 billion people. It's a wicked problem, wicked in the sense that there are so many things propping it up, and it's hard to, you know, see how we can dig our way out of it. And it's, of course, terrible for animals themselves who endure extreme suffering. It's also had severe climate, environmental, and public health impacts. And we at Vox's Future Perfect section believe that we have to change this system. It's an ethical and ecological urgency. Vox covers factory farming stories all the time. So in a way, this package is an extension of what we've always been doing, but we wanted to really go big with it, to give it the kind of treatment we think it deserves, to recruit some high profile writers and to propose ideas that hopefully can be genuinely helpful for moving forward.
Kenny, what would you like to add? How do you explain where we are right now? As Marina points out in her piece, animal rights activism and plant-based eating are more visible than ever. A handful of animal protection groups have managed to win major state and local animal welfare laws and extract concessions from mega corporations. And yet, by any honest measure, the industrialized exploitation and abuse of animals is rapidly getting worse. Animal advocates are losing the fight. What do you think explains this?
Yeah, I think Marina nailed it there. We're at this strange paradox in factory farming, in which animal advocates are starting to ban some of the most cruel and abusive practices at the state level, like confining animals in tiny cages and persuading corporations to ban these practices from their supply chains. So there's some progress there. But if you look on the other side of the ledger, the number of animals raised for food, both in the US and globally, keeps rising. And I think there are a lot of factors as to why this is the case. I think one of them is that the meat and dairy industries have been incredibly effective at using the government, frankly, to grow and make meat more affordable and efficient in some ways, but also to use the government to prevent regulation so that society kind of pays the costs for factory farming by way of environmental pollution, climate change, and threats to public health, like animal-borne pandemics. So we really wanted to kind of capture this moment where we're at a turning point in the fight against factory farming, and also look to the future as to how we might be able to reform it in the United States and look for alternatives like plant-based eating. But then also look to the future and how, unfortunately, the factory farm model that was born in the United States and spread to Europe is now spreading globally.
Marina, what else would you like to add about where we are right now? How this issue is getting more attention than ever, and yet meat consumption is on the rise around the globe.
Yeah, I would say that, you know, and we'll talk about this a little bit more in a minute, I think, but I think that the, as Kenny said, we're kind of at a weird inflection point or impasse in the movement where it feels like the movement against factory farming is kind of stuck. Meat consumption is rising relentlessly. I guess I would add that I think that the future of this, the fight and whether we're able to make a meaningful dent in the meat industry will hinge on the climate movement and whether climate and environmental advocates are able to integrate the scientific consensus on the need to reduce meat consumption to meet climate targets. You know, the scientific consensus on that is very clear, but it's still, it's missing from a lot of the environmental advocacy that happens in the US. And, you know, climate has, I would say, certainly has more mainstream legitimacy, more, you know, credibility in influencing policy and legislation than animal welfare advocacy does. And I think that whether we're able to make real progress on the issue will depend on whether climate advocates can be brought on board and we can build a big tent coalition working, you know, on all of the pillars of harm created by factory farming.
What would you both say are the top three causes? I'm just thinking about globalization. I'm thinking about, you know, people having a bit more money in certain countries, and so they have access to more meat, culture, social media, that there's a huge movement for people just to eat meat. There's the keto diet, the carnivorous diet. I'm seeing so much more of that now on social media. And then, of course, just how massive these industries are. I don't even know if most people can name more than three of these companies that sell. We say meat, we say chicken, but we don't. It's so interesting to me that we don't name the names like Exxon, Chevron, Shell. We hardly say, Tyson or some of these other major companies. I mean, I can't even think of five off the top of my head right now. It's just really interesting how this whole industry is covered. We might say beef, but we don't name the name of the company. So what are your thoughts about that, Kenny?
Yeah, I think the industry has really successfully shaped both culture and politics to benefit its bottom line. You know, you asked what are some of the main driving forces that brought us to where we are today. I think culture is part of it. You know, meat is kind of tied to ideals of prosperity and masculinity. And as people around the world climb out of poverty, which is an incredible thing, that also tends to lead to higher meat and dairy production and consumption. As Marina alluded to earlier, technological advancements have also made factory farming, you know, cheaper and more efficient, which has led to growing ever more and more animals in confined spaces, which brings down production costs and ultimately cost for consumers. But then, as I mentioned earlier, there's also policy in which our agricultural system is really set up to make meat as cheaply as possible and to make the public kind of take on the costs of its production through pollution and climate change and, in a way, animal cruelty. As to your question about why consumers just don't know as much about, you know, the leading meat companies as they do about the leading energy companies such as Exxon, you know, and Mobil and Shell, I think part of it is that these industries have also been very successful at kind of being behind the scenes operators. So as one example, many of these companies have multiple brand names. So you might go to the store and see 5 or 10 brand names, but only a handful of companies are behind them. And they often have names like Prairie Fresh or different labels that allude to this notion that these animals were raised on small family farms when really they were raised on factory farms. So it's been very successful at creating this narrative that it's an industry of a network of small family farms that raise animals humanely when it couldn't be further from the truth. These industries have also been really successful at preventing the public from seeing what goes on inside factory farms. In the United States, there's been a number of states that have passed so-called ag gag laws that make it a crime to publish videos of factory farm abuses.
What would you add, Marina?
Yeah, I think what everything Kenny said was great. I would add that I think there's a really interesting dynamic between the kind of the romantic cultural associations we have with livestock farming, animal husbandry, you know, the image of the cowboy and ranching and happy cows in, you know, on pasture. I think there's an interesting dynamic between that and the livestock industry's ability to, you know, to use our warm fuzzy feelings to essentially by policy exempt themselves from regulation, and also, and also force their way into public life in ways that many people don't give a second thought to. A great example of this that Kenny has written about earlier this year is how the dairy industry took over American schools. Many people probably have memories of the milk cartons that were available in their school cafeterias growing up, or maybe have children who are in that system now. That exists because the U.S. has a strange system of requirements for public schools to buy dairy and more or less force it onto school children, and for kids that are allergic to milk or just don't want it, it's hard to opt out. It's this kind of a pillar of American life that just, you know, that what could be more natural, feeding cows milk to growing children, that in fact is not necessary nutritionally. It's terrible for the climate, and it exists because of industry power.
What's also interesting to talk about is we've done a couple of shows about how cancer rates are on the rise. And according to the National Cancer Institute, red meat is associated with an increased risk of colon and rectum cancer. And evidence also suggests it's associated with prostate and pancreatic cancer. Examples of red meat include beef, pork, and lamb. Processed meats are red meat, and poultry products that have been preserved by smoking, curing, salting, and or the addition of chemical preservatives. So we're talking about hot dogs, sausages, bacon, and luncheon meat. So again, I'm reading right now from the National Cancer Institute. So this is starting to get a lot more mainstream coverage. And Marina, in your piece, you write that Americans are now eating less red meat, but they're eating a lot more chickens, the most abused animal on the planet, who make up more than 90% of the 10 billion animals slaughtered annually in the United States. So tell us more about this and how that's changed.
Yeah, so the U.S. used to be much more of a beef and sheep's meat and lamb eating country, and that has been shifting in recent decades. I believe it was at some point in the 90s when chicken consumption per capita in the U.S. surpassed beef consumption for the first time. We've seen a trend over recent decades of beef consumption plummeting. A lot of that has probably been because of, as you said, increased awareness of the health impacts of eating red meat. So we've seen beef consumption steadily, you know, replaced by chicken, and per capita chicken consumption is still growing every year in the U.S. You know, there's no, it's unclear when it'll top out, and there are really difficult trade-offs here, right? Beef is undoubtedly the worst food for the climate. It's the most highly polluting food in terms of greenhouse gas emissions. Chicken is undoubtedly has the most animal welfare harms of any meat, or I should say any, you know, land animal meat. Fish are a totally different conversation that we can probably bracket for our purposes here. But chickens, because they are, you know, chickens are small animals. And, you know, as a result, it takes many more individual chickens to produce the same amount of meat as a cow. So if you visualize a cow, it's an enormous, an enormous animal weighing multiple times the weight of a human. A chicken is less than 1/10 of the weight of a human. So you need many more chickens to feed a family of four, let's say, at a dinner table. Those numbers add up really, really quickly. And what it adds up to is that we kill, the more we replace beef with chicken, the more we slaughter astronomically more chickens. And chickens make up the vast, vast majority of the 10 billion land animals slaughtered for food in the U.S. They make up about 9 billion of that number. And chickens are also, you know, because they're, I think people tend to empathize with them less. They don't, you know, unlike mammals, they don't show emotions on their faces. They're kind of more foreign animals to us. They are exempt from, they're exempt from animal welfare regulations that are applied to mammals. So chickens get, and other birds too, like turkeys, chickens and turkeys get no humane protection at the slaughterhouse, for example, whereas mammals like cows and pigs and sheep are, at least in theory, required to be stunned and rendered unconscious before slaughter. So it's, you know, we've had a major shift from beef to chicken, and the animal welfare implications of that have been really, really profound.
Kenny, can you talk before we go to break about how raising and feeding and growing chickens has changed drastically over the past couple of decades? Marina writes, chickens farmed for meat grow so large, so fast that they live in chronic pain and their legs often cannot support their weight. Egg-laying hens produce 20 times more eggs than their wild animal counterparts. Back in 2014, your colleague Susanna Locke wrote a piece called Chickens Have Gotten Ridiculously Large Since the 1950s. And she shows a photo of a chicken in 1957 weighing 905 grams. And then in 2005, the chicken is almost four times as big. So things have drastically changed here. They've just been bred to be much bigger. Can you talk about that?
That's right. Yeah. Beginning around the 1930s and 40s, chicken producers and farmers really took interest in changing how they bred chickens to make them grow as big and as fast as possible to make them more efficient. And they maximized growing their breasts to be as big as possible because that was the most valuable and desired part of the bird. And as a result, these chickens are now growing so big and so fast, so top heavy, that many of them have difficulty even walking because their tiny little legs can't support their large bodies. I've heard activists kind of liken it to trying to hold up a watermelon with two toothpicks. And so the chicken of today looks dramatically smaller and different than the chicken of 100 years ago. Some activists just kind of call it as like chickens are prisoners of their own bodies because they are not only in terrible environments, but they can't get out of the biological conditions that genetics companies have imposed on them. And so it's created a number of welfare issues that have led to, as Marina put it, chickens are now really the most abused animal on the planet, both in severity by each chicken, but also in number. Because in the United States, about 9 of the 10 billion, or 9 out of every 10 farmed animals are chickens. And it's also made chicken incredibly cheap. You know, it's significantly more affordable than beef and a good amount more affordable than pork, which has led to a dramatic increase in its consumption. It's also typically viewed as a healthier form of protein, which has been another factor in its rapid rise.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. That is Kenny Torella, a staff writer for Vox's Future Perfect section. We're also joined by Marina Balatnikova, who is an editor for Vox's Future Perfect section. And today we are talking about a new 10-part series from Vox called How Factory Farming Ends. Meat consumption is rising around the world, even as climate scientists say it needs to rapidly decline in rich countries in order to meet global climate targets. More than 80 billion animals are slaughtered for human consumption every year. That number has risen for the past 60 years. So what are your thoughts? This issue is getting so much more attention. How is it affecting the choices that you and your family make? What are your thoughts about scientists saying if we really want to meet global climate targets and truly tackle the climate crisis, we've got to change our ways here. This is just not sustainable for many reasons. So what are your thoughts on this? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow and on Wednesday, we will be talking about the presidential debate, which is tomorrow night. What questions are you hoping the moderators ask during tomorrow night's debate? It's probably going to be watched by millions and millions of people across this country. It might even break records. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email yourcall at kalw.org. And if you'd like to join today's conversation about a 10-part series from Vox called How Factory Farming Ends, we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts about these issues? We're just learning so much more about how meat consumption is affecting the planet, is affecting land, our soil, our health. So how do you respond when you hear stories about these issues and when you hear climate scientists say that in rich countries where people have choices, meat consumption must rapidly decline in order to meet global climate targets and to truly tackle the climate crisis? We'd love to hear from you. Also, if you have any questions for our guests, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall at kalw.org. Marina Balatnikova is an editor for Vox's Future Perfect section. We're also joined today by Kenny Torella, a staff writer for Vox's Future Perfect section. And you can find all of the stories in this piece at kalw.org, click news, and then your call. Let's hear from a caller. Let's go to Eric in San Francisco. Hi, Eric. Welcome to the show.
Hear me? I can't hear you very well. So, hello?
Hi, Eric.
Go ahead.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, good. So, your guests are saying a lot of great stuff. I've been a vegan for 30 years. And primarily now for environmental reasons. But the one thing that I'm not hearing that's absolutely crucial is to talk about deforestation and habitat destruction, which is in an immediate sense even more damaging right now than the climate crisis and animal and agriculture impacts on the climate crisis. It's important to add that in and make sure it's part of the picture, because as we can see on social media, it's easier to debate the climate crisis because it's really amorphous, and you've got to go into the science of how it happens. it's not hard to debate that the more animals we eat, the more land we have to take up, and the more habitat we destroy, and the more Amazon forest we destroy, etc. And if we make that part of the picture, it makes it easier for us to make the argument that people need to stop eating animals and animal products. So that's it.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for that. Would you like to take that one first, Kenny?
Yeah, thanks for your call, Eric, and your absolutely right. And I think it's a point that often gets missed in the environmental and climate debate over our food system. So if you look globally, the number one cause of deforestation is animal agriculture. It's primarily to clear land for grazing cattle and other livestock, but also to clear land to grow corn and soy that are then fed to livestock. And this is actually directly linked to climate change too, because deforestation is a big part of climate change, because when forests are cleared, it releases a significant amount of carbon dioxide. So not only does it release carbon dioxide, but then those trees and forests can't suck up carbon dioxide that they otherwise would. So it has this double effect on climate. But because animal agriculture is also the leading cause of deforestation, it's also the leading cause of biodiversity loss and habitat loss, because land that was once home to wildlife has now been cleared and is dedicated to growing meat and dairy. So this is an often underappreciated part of the environmental conversation, and I appreciate Eric bringing it up.
Yeah, thank you so much. Global Forest Watch reports that overall beef is responsible for 36% of all agriculture-linked forest replacement. Marina, what would you like to add?
Yeah, I just want to thank you to the listener, because you're absolutely right. And I think Kenny nailed this. This is an important part of the conversation that we ought not to neglect. Livestock production has a few different categories of environmental impact. It's not just climate change, but also localized pollution, like extreme levels of localized pollution in the regions that have a high concentration of factory farms in them. And also another category I would consider to be its harms to biodiversity and wildlife. Not a lot of people know that, as Kenny said, livestock production is the world's leading driver of extinction and biodiversity loss. And that's because, you know, it's important to understand the reason for that is because animal agriculture is so land hungry. It's more land hungry than any other human activity. Animal agriculture alone takes up more than one third of the planet's habitable land. And that means all of that land is cleared of its native ecosystem that biodiverse native animals and plants depend on.
And again, this issue is getting a lot of attention in the mainstream press. Here's a piece from the Washington Post in 2022. Demand for meat is destroying the Amazon. Smarter choices at the dinner table can go a long way to help. And then in December in the New York Times, Brazilian state seeks millions in environmental damage from giant meat packer. Rondonia state officials say JBS, the world's biggest meat producer, is buying cattle raised in an illegally deforested Amazon reserve. And then one more thing I think is so important. We've been wanting to do a show about this for a while, Eric, so thanks for bringing it up. You reminded me of a piece out of the Bureau of Investigative Journalism. This was in March of last year. The collagen craze is driving deforestation and rights abuses. For the first time, an investigation has linked collagen powder to violence against indigenous peoples in Brazilian forests. So according to this report, collagen is extracted from fish, pig, and cattle skin. But behind the wildly popular bovine variety lies an opaque industry driving the destruction of tropical forests that fuels violence and human rights abuses in the Amazon. They named Nestle-owned Vital Proteins. It's a collagen supplement championed by Jennifer Aniston. It's sold globally. So we're definitely going to do a show about that because it is so important. So thank you for bringing up deforestation. Marina, did you want to jump in there?
Oh, just the collagen issue. I've read about, and I'm hardly an expert on its effect on skincare, but my sense is that it's, collagen supplements are kind of an unproven skincare product that's gotten, that there's been a kind of a craze around because of the broader skincare craze. And even if it were, even if it were effective, I would question whether, that's a good use of our valuable, valuable planetary resources.
Well, thanks again for the call, Eric. Ruby writes, not only is meat bad for the planet, but the amount of saturated fat is off the charts. That kind of fat, animal, not plant, as in olive oil, adds to plaque in the arteries and can cause strokes and heart attacks. I have two stents. I have to keep 15 grams of saturated fat per day. I've never been a foodie, but now only think about what I'm putting in my body in numbers. How much? Saturated fat, carbs, sugar, etc. No romance, just science. You are what you eat. For that reason alone, meat ought to be reduced, that in our environment. Well, thanks for the comment, Ruby. To add to what we were talking about earlier about where we are right now, Ruby is right. And this issue is getting more attention than ever. Just the effect of so much meat and what it ha the effect that it has on our health. I mean, it's getting its attention on shows like the Today Show, Good Morning America. It feels like it's getting nonstop coverage, Kenny.
Yeah, that's right. And I think it's a complicated issue when it comes to health because nutrition science is messy and it's hard to tease out exactly how one's diet affects their long-term health outcomes. But a lot of meta-analyses have found that generally, when people eat, less meat and more plant-based foods, they put themselves at lower risk of heart disease, type 2 diabetes, and some forms of cancer. And I should clarify that I'm not a doctor. This is not nutritional advice. And certainly, there's a lot of nuance here. There are unhealthy vegans, there are very healthy omnivores, there's everything in between. But generally, the less meat you eat and the more whole plant-based foods you consume, you're probably going to see better health outcomes in the long term.
Yeah, and there's so many studies out there. I mean, here's one from the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health called Consuming High Amounts of Saturated Fats Linked to Increased Heart Disease. We're talking about red meat, dairy, fat, butter, lard, palm oil may increase the risk of coronary heart disease, according to the study. And there's just so many out there if you just put in saturated fat and cardiovascular disease. So thank you for that email, Ruby. Let's go to a few more callers. Let's hear from Greg in Palo Alto.
Hi, Greg.
Hi. Well, I agree that deforestation is a problem. I'm wondering why agencies like the state EPA in California and other agencies haven't gone after the industries because of the waste products. And, dairy farms, cattle ranching, the chicken poultry industries produce an enormous amount of waste material, and they consume enormous amounts of water. And it seems to me that from an environmental standpoint, that would be a way to attack it. I'm not sure why these agencies at the state level haven't moved against this. And I'm wondering what your guests think about, or have they seen, lawsuits or legal action taken against these industries based on their environmental impacts.
Well, thank you for
that, Greg. A piece from Civil Eats says the California dairy industry uses more than enough water to provide the daily recommended water usage for every resident of San Jose and San Diego combined. Marina, why do you think this doesn't get more attention from state politicians? And then we can talk about the federal level.
There's a concept we often think about and write about in our pieces on animal agriculture ad vox called agricultural exceptionalism. Kenny wrote an explainer of this idea that you can find by Googling vox agricultural exceptionalism, but it's a doctrine found in U.S. policy, also policy elsewhere, like in the European Union, according to which livestock production and agriculture more broadly is exempt from the labor and environmental and, you know, and social welfare rules that other industries are required to play by. And we see that manifested in many ways with respect to this question. Animal agriculture is not regulated in the same way that other industries are under the Clean Water Act and Clean Air Act. And right now there's a factory farm water pollution lawsuit set to start later this month, brought by Food and the organization Food and Water Watch. That's an advocacy organization that does a lot of really great research and advocacy on factory farming. They are suing the U.S. EPA for essentially failing to effectively regulate livestock operations from the Clean Water Act.
Kenny, what are your thoughts? I remember when we were going through major droughts in California, we were told to take shorter showers, to not water as much, you know, don't wash your clothes during certain periods, which is really important. But I don't remember any mention of food. So why do you think state and local officials don't spend more time on these issues?
I think there are a lot of reasons, and one of the driving ones is what Marina mentioned, the concept of agricultural exceptionalism, that agriculture is indeed an essential part of our economy, and therefore regulators give agriculture significant leeway to pollute or abuse animals or workers with little to no consequences. I think one problem is that often at the local or state level, you know, agribusiness has kind of captured these agencies and state legislatures. So agribusiness spends more on lobbying than pretty much any other sector. And more often than not, in large agricultural states, the agencies that are supposed to regulate farming are led by farmers themselves or staffed up by farmers or by people that come from farming communities. So they're less likely to regulate their own. They're less likely to regulate their peers. Another issue is that more often than not, agricultural committees at the state level are chaired by farmers or by politicians from farming communities. And so if an advocate or a politician really wants to push for a bill to regulate factory farms or to improve animal welfare, that bill first has to go through a state legislature's agricultural committee. But because it's chaired by folks from the farming community, it's unlikely to make it out of committee and actually get a floor vote. So there's a lot of factors at the state level that prevent movement. A lot of those are mirrored at the federal level. Another issue that Marina alluded to is that the Clean Air Act and Clean Water Act largely exempt pollution from factory farms. So advocacy organizations and well-meaning politicians also really face these legal barriers to creating change.
Can I ask you both, since there is a major debate tomorrow night and so much is at stake in this election, Kenny, what would you say is at stake in this election? I was thinking about, I think it was Mother Jones that had this piece. Maybe you all reported on it also, how here's one from The Guardian, how Trump officials and the meat industry blocked life-saving COVID controls. A congressional investigation reveals the lengths the meat industry went to downplay the risks to workers and lobbyists who were receptive Trump officials. That got a lot of attention during COVID. I just wonder, Kenny, there's so much at stake in this election. What are your thoughts, given the issues that you write about connected to animal ag and factory farming?
Yeah, I think when it comes to animal welfare and environmental pollution from factory farming, there's always a lot at stake. Unfortunately, the issue rarely rises to the level of national political discourse. And while Republicans tend to score worse on these issues, Democrats don't fare much better. And I think that points to kind of how both political parties are pretty captured by the meat and dairy industries on these issues. You know, if you look at USDA Secretary Vilsack, who was the USDA Secretary under both Obama terms and now under Joe Biden, his policies aren't all that different from a conservative secretary under the USDA. There's kind of a problem within the USDA in that they have this double duty of both regulating and promoting agriculture. And whether a Republican or Democrat is in office, they tend to do much more promotion of agriculture than regulation. That being said, I think, you know, it's more likely that a Harris and Walz administration is going to be better on the environment, even when it comes to factory farming, than a Trump and Vance administration. But there's not tons of daylight between the two political parties when it comes to farming and agriculture.
A question around these issues would never, well, I we should say, not say never, but it's so rare that these issues come up at all. What would you like to hear the candidates asked at the debate on these issues? Kenny?
I think probably the most realistic questions to be asked would be looking at how to improve labor conditions inside slaughterhouses. Working inside a slaughterhouse or on a factory farm, it's considered to be one of the most dangerous jobs in America. And there's a lot that regulators and politicians could do to change that, but we haven't seen really much progress in recent decades. Secondly, I also think there could be opportunities to ask about environmental pollution and greenhouse gas emissions from agriculture. Kamala Harris even brought this up, or this came up for Kamala Harris during a CNN town hall in 2019, where she was asked if she would support the U.S. dietary guidelines recommending less red meat. And she actually said she would support it, which is something that nutrition experts have supported for years. So it was interesting to see Harris support that policy idea. At the same time, Tim Walz, you know, he's the governor of Minnesota, a major ag state, and he seems like he might be kind of reluctant to really reforming the factory farming system. So I'll be interested to see if these issues come up at all during the debate. It's likely not, but it's happened before. So I'll certainly be watching for that tomorrow night.
Marina, what would you add? What do you think is at stake in this election?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think what Kenny said is true about how both parties, both major political parties, certainly treat the livestock industry and factory farming favorably. And it's very far from, you know, being a major political issue or a voting issue over which there's, you know, meaningful debate within the Democratic or Republican parties. That, you know, that being said, I think that we're much more likely to see meaningful climate policy that builds on the Inflation Reduction Act from a Democratic administration, and that could perhaps include some progress on the agriculture piece of climate change. So when the IRA passed, Vox did some coverage, you know, unpacking and explaining the bill. And what we found then is that the IRA has really important legislation on decarbonizing the energy sector, on things like, electrifying cars. But the agriculture piece of it, which is, you know, which can't be neglected if we're going to meet climate targets, was really not there. There was very little in the way of policy that would reduce the emissions of the ag sector. And some of the climate incentives that we're seeing out of the USDA are even counterproductive, and we can talk your ear off on that if you're interested. That's something Kenny reported on last year. But I certainly think there's much more space to push a Democratic administration on that issue than a Trump administration. And also, I think what you were alluding to a few minutes ago was the Trump administration's work with the meat industry at the start of COVID. So if you think back to the start of the COVID pandemic, slaughterhouses were one of the biggest hotspots for COVID outbreaks. Many slaughterhouse workers were falling sick. An executive order from the Trump administration basically ordered slaughterhouses to stay open with the reasoning that this is an essential industry to, you know, feeding America and keeping the country running. Later reporting from various outlets revealed that the executive order was basically ghostwritten by the meat industry. And so in kind of exceptional emergency situations like that, I think we're far more likely to see a Trump administration do favors for the meat industry, let's say.
Kenny, just quickly, I thought about that when RFK Jr. joined Trump's campaign and says he's going to make America healthy again.
Yeah. RFK Jr. is an interesting political figure.
We have about a minute left. Go ahead.
Yeah, he's an interesting political figure for many reasons. He peddles strange conspiracy theories about vaccines and many other issues. At the same time, he has a history of fighting environmental pollution. So I thought, he was an interesting choice that he went with former President Trump and endorsed that campaign. And because, you know, Trump was terrible on the environment, and RFK Jr. has often worked on both environmental and personal health issues. But I'm guessing the conspiratorial side of his won out, and he endorsed the former president. But it'll be interesting to see if RFK Jr. Has any influence in a Trump administration, if he indeed wins, and what that might look like for the environment and public health.
Kenny Torella is a staff writer for Vox's Future Perfect section. Marina Bolotnikova is a editor with Vox's Future Perfect section. And you can find the 10-part series from Vox, How Factory Farming Ends, on our website, kalw.org. Click news and then your call. Kenny and Marina, thanks to you and your team for this series. We'd love to have you back, as well as some other writers. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.